ACCA, the world's most forward-thinking professional accountancy body.
Welcome to episode 3 of ACCA's Rethinking Risk podcast series. I'm Rachel Johnson, and I'm here as Head of Risk Management and Corporate Governance for ACCA's Professional Insights team to present a series of interviews with prominent risk influencers and commentators on how to navigate the choppy waters we found ourselves living in due to COVID-19 and its many ripple effects. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Ariane Chappell, an award-winning author and consultant with 20 years experience working and now also teaching in operational risk management. Operational risk indeed has taken on a new meaning this year, given what the pandemic has proved about non-financial risks and, for example, in terms of their materiality and interconnectedness. And we are very fortunate to speak with Ariane today about her popular book, Operational Risk Management: Best Practices in the Financial Services Industry, which won Risk Magazine's prestigious Book of the Year Award for 2020. So welcome, Ariane.
Thank you. Hi. Thank you very much for having me.
Our pleasure. So I know from my alma mater, Risk Magazine, that back in 2017, you told an audience of skeptical financial professionals at a conference in Vienna how operational risk would in time become a greater concern for the financial industry than credit and market risks. I just wondered if you could draw on the best takeaways from your book, given what's happened this year, and please also give us your views on how the pandemic has shed new light on operational risk.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this first question. And let me tell you that I'm very impressed that you know about the Vienna conference 3 years ago and the blog I wrote about this coming back. And indeed, after this conference, I really had the feeling that operational risk would take over financial risk, so credit and market risk for banks, in terms of its importance, not only in terms of size, but in terms of volatility, in the sense that banks do credit risk for hundreds of years and do market risk for decades. And these are risks that are largely well understood, unless when you go a bit exotic, like with exotic derivatives that led to the subprime crisis. But, you know, by and large, traditional financial risk management is relatively well understood. And because it's well understood, it's better managed. And hearing at this conference about the worries about resourcing and good quality people to face large risk, like obviously cybersecurity, but also the digitalization, the transformations of the business model, the external events, the complexity of regulatory context and constraints, it really seemed like this was a risk that was growing at a very interesting pace, to put it that way. And when I wrote this blog, I had two types of comments. One was like, no way, you know, this is a small discipline. And others said, yes, absolutely. Or it had already taken over financial risk. So some people not only agreed with me, but said it was already the case. I think 3 years down the line now, and especially in the lights of COVID, it's hard to deny the importance of non-financial risk management in the life of the financial sector, but obviously also on all the other sectors. Now, to talk about the books, because you have the questions about the takeaway from the book. Look, the genesis of this book, who was in dormant for years, and I never took the time because I was too busy teaching and consulting the whole idea of the opportunity cost to really sit down and put black on white, which I eventually did, mm-hmm. commentary of everything I do in my course. So I'm teaching for nearly 30 years now, initially at university and initially financial risk management, macroeconomics, microeconomics, and investments. And then later on, operational risk. And now I teach executive audience for over 12 years in risk management. And so I finally sat down and put the written version, if you want, of all my courses, but also all the experience I built over 20 years in risk management. And the subtitle of the book, it's called Best Practices in the Financial Industry. And I think also what this COVID crisis has demonstrated, and it was a very, very much a surprise to me, to be honest, is like everybody struggles in risk, with risk management, especially the governments. I mean, seeing the puzzle and the struggles of the governments in dealing with this crisis, in choosing about the risk, in balancing one effect to the other, was I must say, a very sour discovery. Call me naive. And so it turns out that whereas I was quite severe in how the financial industry is managing their risk, comparatively speaking, they're doing quite well. So I would say, in terms of taken away, there's probably a lot of takeaways in a good practice that's happening now in the financial industry for other sectors to draw upon and develop their risk management framework. And that's what we've seen happening actually now.
Mm. It's incredible how spot on correct you were in 2017 then, and especially when you think of the way and indeed the velocity of how risk, operational risk especially, has evolved just this year. So your book and the attention it has received in 2020 resonates well with those financial professionals with accounting backgrounds. So I wondered what with TCFD and the accelerating focus on ESG, you know, how you see accountancy playing a bigger role in risk management.
Look, accountants are very important and in all sorts of measures, and not only the recent and regulatory development. And because I speak to an audience of accountants, let me share an anecdote or an experience with you. When I started Operational Risk 20 years ago at ING Group, there was no collection of incidents. It was very, very early on, the standalone Excel spreadsheet that ING had developed at the time. They improved since then, let me specify, but it was all very rudimentary, and I needed a quick way to demonstrate and to measure first, to measure how much the bank was losing in operational risk incidents without having any way to build up or any time to build up for new incidents. So I went to and sat 3 days next to the guy who was maintaining the general ledger at ING Southwest Europe for the group I had in scope as the new head of op risk. And for 3 days, we went through the accounts and we selected the lines in the general ledger that could proxy operational risk events. And I was very lucky that the general ledger was articulated in a way that I could find easily these proxies. I'll pass on the technicalities. And I also used several sources of data in the firms, like IT logs and provisionings. Or provisioning is also in accounting, but I had it in the legal department. So all that to say that in the very first days, in the very first weeks of my profession, or the beginning of my career in operational risk, my biggest ally was the accounting team, because I thought, well, if it's out of the account, if it's coming out, that's, and for the wrong reasons, that's a very good proxy for operational risk. And since then, let alone that I always like accounting, since then it was an important function. Mm-hmm. Now, I also make, and you probably don't know that, but it's coincidental you reach out, so thank you again for that. But I also make the parallel between accountant and risk managers. And I have a wonderful accountant, by the way, Olga. Hi, Olga, who's ICCA accredited. But I also I always make the parallel between accountant and risk manager in the sense that they are advisors. They can give you insights if your accounts are well done. They you know, they are the specialist advisors that you can listen to and then take a decision as a business manager, because besides being a specialist in risk management, I also run my firm. I'm also a firm director and an entrepreneur, and my accounting team are real allies in my management accounting. So I would say, yes, they're absolutely important.
Yeah, that's such an interesting perspective. And I also wonder how you think the growing awareness of operational risks is impacting business models and influencing risk appetites in that respect?
Look, when your risk appetite is something flexible, needs to be refreshed in the context of environment. And this is a question I have a lot when I teach, about every week actually, for various audiences on risk appetite and key risk indicators. And the question is, should we refresh our risk appetite? And I'm like, yes, absolutely. Because if I take just the financial sector, but it's easily generalizable to every industries. Everybody's working from home. Our exposure to digitalizations and systems and cyber attacks is of course multifold compared to where it was in March. The supervision of team, the management of team, the leaderships of teams is all impacted. And of course, firms have to adjust to this new way of working. Now, I must say that the irony was that what the financial industry in particular was fearing the most was cyber attack and business disruption. Mm-hmm. And that's how they build on resilience, and they were insistent on operational resilience. And what came was a different sources entirely. I mean, what disrupted us was everything but this system. And so I'm still very admirative on how the financial industry resisted the disruptions of this crisis and could execute the essential functions, even though what allowed us to sustain this was the opposite of what we were fearing. We were fearing a system disruption, and it's the system that saved us. So
yeah. Yeah, really fascinating. How do you think ERM best practices need to change in order to better replicate, a firm's operational risk profile?
There's another name for operational risk in the financial industry, which is non-financial risk, because operational risk is called operational risk in the financial sector, as opposed to financial risk like credit and marketing banks and actuarial risk in insurance companies. And yet some banks or financial firms are calling up risk a non-financial risk. Non-financial risk is every risk for the non-financial industry. So what the financial sector called ORM, usually the non-financial sector called ERM. Now, there's also something you mentioned when we were talking about this broadcast, and it's the interconnectivity. Mm-hmm. And I think the interconnectivity of risk is absolutely spot on. You said I was spot on, but when we prepared this, you were absolutely spot on by mentioning the interconnection. I think what the COVID has demonstrated, or the crisis, and more importantly, the response to this crisis as demonstrated, is that taking risk in isolation is an absolute fallacy. We're mentioning 2017. I wrote a blog in 2017 on this, and that's the chapter 4 of my book, and I talk a lot about this during my webcasts in March and April. When banks had pandemic scenarios in the old days, you know, this distance past, or that seemingly distance past of early 2020, pre-March, their pandemic scenarios were something isolated in retrospect, quite naive, like how are we going to continue working with 30% of the workforce being absent and at home because they're sick? And no one had envisaged, and I was the last of them, envisaging the tsunami of response that we saw in COVID, with the international lockdown and with the governments blocking everything and people working from home and entire parts of the economy shutting down, just like if it was the Black Plague. And I'm going to refrain very much of formulating a value judgment here, because these opinions are as diverse as individual. But what was, regardless of not you support this public response, what was a surprise to everybody is this domino effect that created by a single event. And so the benefit of this is that it has highlighted, when too few people was mentioning is the interconnected between risks. And now there is an advanced practice in firms, which was already emerging, but now accelerating in tier one banks, is the modeling and the management and the assessment of these risks much more in an interconnected manner than they were before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, we have seen too, just like you mentioned with the silos. I mean, risk is definitely in the air that we breathe, and it's like sustainability. It's impacting everything, every process, every stakeholder, and it's in the sheer velocity of how fast that's changing. It has been really incredible. So, in the book, do you touch more onto about you know, it's about mitigating the risk, but what are the opportunities to create value? And if so, where and how? And is that, how does that compare with like large firms, small firms, and so on?
Two things here. I'd like to have a twofold question, so I'm going to answer it in two parts. No, that's absolutely fine. So first question, let's say, is the book applicable to everybody? So, and I'll take your questions in the reverse order. Mm-hmm. Look, yes, I think absolutely it is. Now, obviously, it describes the practice in the financial industry. It's first targeted to the industry I know best and I work the most of, although this is less and less true in terms of volumes of work. But it's also described the financial industry because it's the industry that has been the most heavily regulated and for the longest time in terms of operational risk per se. Now, I'm not disputing the fact that aviation industries and pharmaceutical industries and energy company have been heavily regulated as well, you know, and accounting industry or professions. So that's not what I mean. But in terms of holistic risk management, there are sorts of models now. Now, in terms of volumes of work, I do a lot of work with public bodies, international financial institutions, but also UN agencies and firms of all size. And in the courses, we're going to talk about courses later, but in the course I designed also online called Essentials of Risk Management, I take very much the perspective of young entrepreneurs or, you know, even small businessmen. It is applicable if you are more at the level of principles and methods, whether it's, you know, the UK governments or US governments or public bodies. I just had a coaching session with public institutions here in the UK around risk management. So I'd like to think that is very much applicable to everything. One of my kids, my adult daughter, for instance, is working with a charity business and ground up organizations, and she's going to develop a risk management framework based on everything we discuss here. So that's for the applicability. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of opportunities, I love the question because there's in the conclusions of the book, so in the last 3-4 pages, where basically the where I dream where the operational risk management and the risk management profession in general will get to. I introduced a concept which I'm pushing more and more now about positive risk management. And positive risk management is exactly what you describe. It's not only having this speech of let's mitigate the downside, let's avoid the losses, but more how can we capture the benefits and how can we improve performance, but stabilizing performance. And honestly, I said I won't voice my opinion, but I will a little bit. That's what I find quite puzzling. In the COVID crisis, it's all around mitigating the downside and mitigating some particular disastrous effect, but not enough around how do we capture the upside of it? How do we adjust to capture the benefit of some volatility? Because volatility means going up and down. So yes, this grasping opportunities is absolutely essential in risk management.
Yes, I think I'm having more and more conversations every week about never waste a good crisis. So I'm glad you touched on that as well in the bits in the book also. So I know we talked a little bit about the public sector, and We've seen how different countries have responded throughout the pandemic, and I wondered what your views are about public policy and what they could do more to help the financial services sector do to help build a better resiliency for the future and in a you know, kind of greener, more inclusive, sustainable recovery. And maybe, sorry for the double-barreled question again, but also maybe mention what you expect to come out of the recent consultation from Basel, BIS. Okay.
The consultation on resilience, not the
operational resilience.
Okay. No, I'm laughing because I'll try to be nice, which in itself answers your question. Okay. So a bit more seriously, something brilliant, although almost inadvertently brilliant, that the regulators have done in 2018 and in the UK was the consultative paper of the Bank of England and the PRA and the FCA, so the UK regulator on operational resilience that I was touching upon a bit earlier. And I say inadvertently brilliant because human beings are very good at what I call predicting the past or, you know, closing the stables when the horses have bolted. And the paper, the resilience paper brought by the regulator in 2018 was very much a response to the TSB crisis. So for those who are not familiar to the news in the UK, it was this online bank who, for reasons I spare the audience, experienced a massive business disruptions and shut down of their account and their banking transactions, millions of customers, and struggled like crazy to recover the events. And that created, there were headline news for weeks and created a massive customer impact. And that led to the departure of risk management, parliamentary inquiry. It was a massive, massive headlines in the UK. And so as a response, the regulator had a paper on resilience and focuses on operational risk resilience and required some actually some very demanding views of interconnectedness of processes and to guarantee a response to the service to the regulator. And so the paper was reading very much like a one-to-one response to this crisis. You need to not look at your process so much as creating continuity of service to the regulator. And I said it was inadvertently brilliant because the banks were so much focused on creating resilient service that when the COVID crisis hit and the supply chains were completely disrupted and Sainsbury's couldn't transport toilet paper due to a completely unanticipated reactions of human irrationality, the banks were on a very different level, very organized to executing the payment systems. And even though everybody was working from home, they had essential teams on site to keep executing their core transactions. So the resilience of the supply chains or the service chain of the banks were absolutely amazing. And there were two consultative documents published by BIS in August, one on the sound practices of operational risk, which I think is great. It's really matured. It's been, now the sound practices have been published for the first time in 2001. So it's now version 5, I think, and it's a wonderful consultation. There's the other consultations on resilience, and that's why I ask you to specify the question, which is again, it's a lot less mature. And again, as the other paper was a response to the TSB crisis, this paper reads very much like a response to the COVID crisis around the working from home and adjusting your supply chains or adjusting your operations when the context is different and with a number of disruptions of the external events, which is fine. But I think the sector will need to mature with the experience of the years, because what will be the next one and what will be the next one? And what I think we need to still learn and mature and reflect on is what do we mean by resilience, and can we come up with principles that are a bit more generic than the last year's events. Now, let me give you one. Well, that anticipates your next questions, I assume. But just to finish on this resilience, what would be, if you allow me, what would be for me, and based on my own experience of adjusting my business on the 13th of March when everything shut down and all my travels that were weekly for the next 3 months disappeared overnight, as I would describe resilience for my business is speed of detection and speed of reaction. So how quickly do you detect an incident? Because how quickly you detect it will allow you to adjust very quickly. And then this adjustment is plan B, basically. Plan B or plan C if your plan B doesn't work. So what's your alternative solutions? How are you going to fill this gap when your horizon changes?
Yes, exactly. I mean, being able to detect some kind of major event like this gray rhino we've had has been the $64 million question. So just when you were talking there, I thought it would be interesting to hear about your experience with consulting with boards. We have a lot of company director members, and we have been holding lots of discussions, thought leadership discussions, on their role in ensuring operational resilience. So I wondered, is there a new paradigm for boards in terms of making better informed decision making and communicating through to stakeholders and shareholders, for example?
Yes and no. That's not a very helpful answer, is it? But let me elaborate on this. Look, I work quite a lot with board and an executive committee. By quite a lot, I mean on average once a week or twice a month, I have sessions with senior management with various companies, and I like doing it a lot because it's one of the quick wins of risk management in terms of raising awareness, and not only raising awareness but identifying top risks. And I have a parallel that I use, an image I use in my courses to distinguish top risks versus bottom-up risk in risk management. Because some people say, oh, you need to reconcile top-down and bottom-up. I said, no, you don't. You need to complement this. And the top-down risk analysis is like the crow's nest of a boat. Okay, you see what's in the distance. You see the storms in the distance. You see if you're going to hit another boat. You see if there's a change of weather or a sand bench or an iceberg. You know, if I take the Titanic, Titanic aspect. And so the board's needs and the senior management are there to see what are the, or to identify and realize what are the large events in the organizations, and the bottom-up risk assessment that you do in businesses and processes are more like your engine room, and is the engine room of the boat, and is, are your processes efficient? Now, why is it a quick win? Is this, when I facilitate a brainstorming workshop with senior executives, I ask them what their concerns are, and I ask them to start with what I call silent voting. It's described in chapter 2 of my book, because I've been doing this for 13 years. I've been doing scenario analysis and identifications with firms for 13 years now, since 2007. And I ask them to write on a piece of paper what their main concerns are. And they, I don't use slides for this presentation. And why it works is that because you start the meeting with them being active, being silent, and writing down their own thoughts, so they don't influence each other at first. And then I feedback once in the list, you know, I take a topic and then we share who else have it, etc. And by having these conversations where it's their own concerns that emerge, I don't have to convince them, or risk function doesn't have to convince them that risking is important, because they're voicing their own concern. And why I do that is because my experience has showed, working with lots of CROs and business executives and risk managers, especially CROs, when a CRO tells me he has a concern, experience shows, and I had four examples that I'm not going to share here in the interest of time and also confidentiality, but in four instances, the worries that they voiced to me materialized in terms of losses between a few months to a year after they said that. So my take is when these people have concerns, they need to be listened to and they need to be addressed. So it's the one of the versions I use, or one of the format I use, which is both useful to raise awareness but also to identify what are the weaknesses in the organization. And why do I say yes and no? I said no in a sense that these sorts of top-down risk analysis has been carried out by large companies, and I have one in particular, but there's many, for years and years and years. So actually, if you have good management, you're doing that. Why do I say yes, it's new, is because something that COVID has reinforced, which I'm very happy about or put forward, is this importance of scenario analysis. And these events that we thought were nearly impossible or, you know, very rare that they could be ignored. And you mentioned Grey Rhino, which is a fantastic concept. But these events that were pushed on the side now are... tend to be a bit more seriously considered, and that's very good for risk management.
Yeah, some of the conversations also I've had with members just about the scenario analysis that they did, like you say, after that COVID struck, have been wild what they found out and what they thought was, they never would have thought could be capable of happening, particularly with supply chains and disruption in every aspect, really, of their business processes. I wanted to end on just what you're doing on the teaching and training front and how you think financial professionals with accountancy backgrounds could help address and quantify operational risks more within their organizations.
Oh, well, look, there's a lot of training we do. Like I said, I'm a teacher for 30 years. And when I moved, if you allow me to share a personal experience, when I moved in to the UK in 2006, leaving university and dropping my tenure and everything I knew and my network in Brussels to come here to marry the man of my dreams and have more kids. So there you go. I arrived in London and I knew no one, but there were two things I knew. Is I knew how to teach and I knew operational risk, or I thought I did. And so I created this firm who's now 40 years old, and I decided to expand it 15 months ago, and then 6 months after that we had COVID. But anyway, and so this training activity has developed over the years into a full suite of CPD accredited training, and we're going to have more accreditations. We have the mandate now with PECB to create the exclusive certifications in operational risk management accredited by PECB in 2021. It's going to come out, but all our course have been accredited, CPD accredited. And so there is enough for everything. One of my vision really, and what I think I want the mission of the firm to be, is to increase the understanding of risk management much beyond the financial industry. So we have online courses starting with Essentials of Risk Management and ORM Boosters. There's a lot more short courses I need to have, because I have hours and hours of recordings that I just need to take the time or find someone to take the time to package. But we also have a live training on risk assessments and best practice in risk management and risk appetite and KRI. So there's a whole suite of risk management course that we keep developing. We have a catalog that will come out for 2021 on resilience, on conduct and culture. So all the and measurement of rare events in operational risk. So I tend to believe that all of the main topics in non-financial risk management, especially for the financial industry, we cover.
Yes, I mean, the broad spectrum of the different types of operational risks are, I mean, we could talk a whole nother hour, I think. But before I do wrap it up and say goodbye, I'm sure everyone's wondering, is there going to be an update to your book or maybe a sequel coming up?
They should, shouldn't it? yeah, I thought about it a few weeks ago and I thought, okay, well, maybe I at some point Not now. I think it's too fresh. But maybe in a year or so, I need to work on a second edition. And of course, there's a chapter 20 is called Resilience and Reputation. Mm-hmm. Why both? Because I thought that when you're more resilient, you improve your reputation. But when you have a bad reputation, you tend to be less resilient because people don't give you a pass. And so that was the interactions I wanted to highlight in this chapter. But definitely they should, I will expand the parts of reputation. I will expand the parts on interconnectivity between risks, expand on scenario analysis, and also on adaptation and innovation. And maybe I will, one of the few final comments on that, because it became apparent to me on one of the last class I was running for Risk.net. I still teach a lot for Risk.net, as you certainly know. Yeah. And when I ask people about their culture and what they wanted to change in terms of their culture of risk, the majority of answers were circling around the need for innovations and the need to adapt. And even though we knew that our environment was changing, it was changing much, what this year has shown is that sometimes it could change into dimensions and scope that we did not anticipate it. And so being quick on your feet and being able to respond quickly to change through innovation, through creativity is particularly clear. And something you mentioned about ESG and sustainability that I did not pick up on much, but as I see the future, I should say the future of the world or the solution to climate change or sustainability or environmental challenges is very much through innovation. And I'm not talking about risk management so much as technical innovations in science and science in the most academic and noble sense, the purest sense of the word. And so I really hope that one of the evolutions of the sector will be to foster this innovation in order to come up with creative solutions to enhance what we're doing so far.
Well, that sounds definitely like something that will become very popular again, not least with ACCA members. So we'll be looking out for that and look forward to having you back with us again. Can't thank you enough, Ariam, for sharing all your thoughtful stories and insights with us. We wish you all the best and look forward to having you back.
Thank you. It was an honor. Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by ACCA. Find out how we think ahead at accaglobal.com.